How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today should be familiar to all of you if you love basketball and podcasts. And if you don't, I don't know what you're doing here. Lee Ellis, longtime member of the No Dunks crew, previously known as the Starters, previously known way back in the day as the Basketball Jones, guys who have just great passion for the game and a lot of fun talking about the game. Lee Ellis, of course, a core of that crew, but not right now. Lee Ellis, not podcasting, not doing anything else about the NBA right now because he is instead touring the world and playing pickup games with strangers in far-flung places. Yes, that's right. He quit his day job to go play hoops in amazing places all over the globe. I just might be a tad jealous. Why is Lee Ellis doing that? That's the really fascinating part. And I'll quickly note here that I learned about Lee's new adventure from a really great piece in the Washington Post by my friend Ben Golliver. You should go read that as well. But if you haven't read it, if you're not familiar with what Lee is doing, I think you'll really enjoy him explain it. Lee is incredibly passionate about the game of basketball, the joys of pickup, connecting with people, all that that brings. He also, of course, loves international travel, so that's part of this. But he's less enthused right now about the state of the NBA, which factored very heavily into this dramatic mid-career detour. But Lee will explain it much better than I can. We will get to all that in just a minute. Before we do, my quick weekly plug, because we are running out of time for you to pre-order this great new book from Sports Illustrated in partnership with Triumph Books. It's about the history of the Lakers. It would be a great gift for all of your friends and family members who are Laker fans or just basketball fans or fans of great sports writing. The book is called The Greatest Show on Earth. Features 15 stories from the pages of SI from the 60s through the present, covering all the Laker legends, Kareem, Magic, Kobe, Shaq, Wilt, everybody. And written by some of the greatest sports writers, of course, of all time, Frank DeFord, Jack McCallum, Lee Jenkins, many others. I had the honor of writing the introduction for the book, available for pre-order right now until December 15th. So you're running short on time here to get the 30% discount. Go to triumphbooks.com, search for Greatest Show on Earth. There's also a direct link in the summary of this podcast, or you can type in a bit.ly link, bit.ly/Lakers75. When you get to checkout, use the discount code Lakers30. Again, you can find the book at triumphbooks.com. Called The Greatest Show on Earth, discount code Lakers30. Okay, my conversation with Lee Ellis is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by the international man of mystery, Lee Ellis, although not international in the moment. He's just in Atlanta, at least for the time being, until the next adventure, which is probably coming soon. Lee, good morning. Welcome.
Hi, Howard. Thanks very much for having me.
No, thank you for being here amid your many, many travels. I'll admit, and I have a whole intro that's coming before this, so people will know the setup for what we were talking about. But I've debated in my own head as I was arranging my interview notes here, as I like to do. I try to be organized and have a plan. Do I start with where you're going and where you've been and what you're doing, or do I start with why you did it? And I've decided my editorial judgment here, my vast journalism experience serving me here, we're going to put aside for the moment the why you're not doing what you used to do. Because I think it's a fascinating discussion and I want to dive into that. But I want to start with the really fun part of this, which is what you are actually doing, which is traveling the globe, playing pickup basketball in far-flung places. You quit your job to just go play pickup. This is the American freaking dream right here. This is amazing. And you've already been to many countries, and the idea is 20 games in 20 cities and 20 countries. So let's start here. How many games in how many cities and how many countries so far as we record this?
So I'm happy to say there's been 5 countries, although the 5th country was Germany, which was actually the first country. I got there because I had a flight delay out of Atlanta going to Slovenia. So I had 12 hours in Frankfurt, and I was like, well, I'm not going to just sit at the airport for 12 hours. I'm just going to go out and see what I can do. And I found a really, really cool court there in Huffman Park. And again, it was a Wednesday morning, so I didn't know who was going to be there, what sort of action was going to be. I started shooting around. A couple of people turned up. This girl turned up, Maria. She was incredible. She walked on the court. It was like a scene from White Man Can't Jump. She started saying, right, let's play, let's play. And I'm like, what's going on here? Is this some sort of like hidden camera show that I'm a part of? I didn't even know. Anyway, she started pulling out all these tricks. She was shooting the ball from like 15 feet behind the backboard. She was doing Steph Curry bombs from 10 feet behind the three-point line, spinning the ball on her finger. She did the splits, knocked in shots. And then she said, let's play a little one-on-one. I started knocking in shots, you know, a couple of shots here and there. And then on three-pointers, she's just turning around, just dismissing my shot out of thin air. Now, I bricked it, so she was right. But it was an incredible start to the journey, unexpected. So it started in Frankfurt. So I'm adding that one to the total. We moved there down to Slovenia and Ljubljana, where, of course, Luka Doncic is from. He has a court there that was made for him about 3 or 4 years ago. I think it was pre-pandemic. So I organized a run there. Now, the run was organized for a Friday afternoon, and because I was late getting there, I turned up on the Thursday morning. I arrived Wednesday night, and on the Thursday morning, I was at the court, and there was a 100% chance of rain on Friday. And I'd already organized with a few people, like, we're playing Friday, 3 o'clock. They've taken days off work and arranged, you know, all sorts of things. So I'm like, what am I? So I'm on Instagram basically saying, if you're coming Friday, if you see this message, please just come Thursday, because I'm not sure Friday is going to happen. I was thinking this is going to be a disaster. As it turns out, we had probably 15 people turn up.
Wow.
It was incredible. Now, we were playing for about an hour, and the clouds came in, a little bit of rain fell, and there was a pub about 10 feet away. So everyone was like, oh, it's pouring with rain, let's go in the pub and have a few beers. So we got the game played, which was great, because Friday it was raining, so it just couldn't have happened. So I got lucky there. Then I moved down to Zagreb in Croatia, where I had a game organized, again, with just with people who follow me on Instagram and Twitter and who knew I was coming. We'd organized the game there. But as it turns out as well, former NBA player Damian Rudej lives in Croatia, and he got wind of what I was doing. And so he actually contacted me and said, hey, I see what you're doing. Let's get together. Let's have lunch and catch up. So we did. And then he said, this was the day after I played the game. So this was on a Monday. And he said, do you want to play again tonight? And I'm like, I wasn't planning on any back-to-backs on this trip, I tell you that. And but you know, you get an invitation from someone like that, and you're like, of course. And so Damian Rudej took us to the court that he played on as a kid, which is literally like a stone's throw from the house he grew up in. We played. It was awesome. And then we went back to his house, and we had a cup of tea with tea leaves grown on his own farm. His mum made them for us. She wasn't expecting us, and she was so hospitable and so generous, but I think she was a little annoyed at her son for saying, you should have told me guests were coming. You know, I could have prepared things. But anyway, then Damian showed us around, again, his bedroom as a kid, where, you know, he wrote on his desk. He did the sign of the Timberwolves. He just drew it artistically and then ended up playing for them later on. And so that was a fantastic experience there. Also, while I was in Zagreb, I went to the Dražen Petrović, basically his cemetery, and then also the museum there. And while I was there, I wasn't expecting this, but I was just walking around, and his mum, Biserka, was right there. And It was almost like she was expecting me. She dropped what she was doing. She was sort of in an office there, and she started showing me around the museum. Now, she doesn't speak really very good English. She was actually speaking more Italian with me. Now, I speak a little bit of Spanish because my wife is from Peru. So her Italian and my Spanish, and, you know, she was sort of gesturing around, showing us things. The funniest part was there's obviously, you know, so much memorabilia there of Dražen. Photos of like against the Dream Team, and she knows all the Dream Team players. She goes, that's Clyde, that's David Robinson, that's Magic, you know. And so that was where the language was perfect. It was awesome. But I just couldn't believe that, you know, she was so generous and so welcoming and just showing a complete stranger around the museum in the way she did. And it was incredibly moving. seeing, it's been nearly 30 years since Drazen passed away. And that the feature that was on TNT a few years ago was sort of running on a continual loop. And we were just watching it together. There were some highlights. And then it sort of transitioned to the car being mangled there. And I sort of looked at her. And again, just you could just see the mother's pain has never really left that moment. You know, it was like it was a very touching moment to sort of see her and that there. So overall, Zagreb, incredible city, just an amazing city. Then I moved to Šibenik, which is where Drazen, of course, played as a professional before moving to the NBA there. And there's a court that's kind of built again in his memory there, which is just it's such a cool court. I got so lucky with the weather while I was out there too, because it was towards the end of the summer, of course. The sun was setting on this court. I was just out there playing. There was a few kids playing around. I didn't actually play a game there. There was a bit of a communication breakdown with my fans who were supposed to be coming. But anyway, still just shooting around and seeing what Drazen means to the people of Croatia. He's more than just a basketball player. He's an icon. He's a legend. He's a god in that sense. And so to be there in Šibenik, incredibly beautiful city, and to have, just to shoot around on that court. There were kids playing during the day as well, which I really love to see how, like, the schools take them out and, get them playing on that court. That was awesome. Then I moved down to Dubrovnik, which is this court that I played on down there. It's built in a castle. It's like a rooftop court, and it overlooks Dubrovnik and it overlooks the Adriatic Sea. And it is the most spectacular scene I think you could possibly hope for to play basketball on. It's just absolutely gorgeous. It's a gorgeous city. Not sure if you've been there or not, but Croatia is...
Sadly, have not yet. It's on my list one of these days. Is that... Wait, so were you weren't playing like in a basketball court in the castle in like King's Landing, were you? Was this a Game of Thrones part of...
Yes, basically. That's it. That's the thing. The court itself, I mean, it's not a great court to play on in the sense that it's kind of small. It's really only half court. It's more, and it's only, I think, 9 foot high rim. It's more just the scene of where you're playing there and the surrounds and the atmosphere and the ambience and all that. And again, like I did a hyperlapse on my phone of the sun setting over the court there, and it's just like, oh my God. I mean, that's the thing with Croatia. Like it's like everywhere you go, it gets more beautiful than the last city. And you're at the point, you're like, this is unbelievable. I don't know which is my favorite city because they're all so incredibly beautiful. Great people. Food is amazing. Easy to get around. So it was fantastic. Mm. So from Dubrovnik, it was then on to Belgrade in Serbia, and another court in the Belgrade fortress there in this old castle that's that was built 279 BC, I believe. So it's thousands of years old. Now, basketball in Serbia is huge. I mean, you've got some of the biggest rivals of all time there in Red Star Belgrade and Partizan Belgrade. And these courts, they actually play some NBA, they have NBA functions in the off-season in the summer there where they go out and they play like 3-on-3 and things like that there. But these courts in Kalemegdan Park, again, it's all about the atmosphere of where you're playing and just soaking it all in and playing on these, really high quality courts. It was incredible. And we had a really good turnout too there in Belgrade. It was, a bit of a cool afternoon, probably about 55 degrees Fahrenheit, but there was clear skies and people came out and it was a Sunday afternoon. We ran for probably 2 hours in the end. People just kept on playing and it was awesome. I mean, it was such a great experience. And then following that, we just stood around on the court as the sun set for probably another hour and a half, 2 hours, just talking, just getting to know each other, hearing about people's love for the game, their stories. They've obviously listened to my podcast that I used to be on and the TV show. And so people had a really good history and understanding of where I come from and why I was where I was at the time. And at the end of the day, people just love playing basketball as well. So that made it awesome. And then I finished up in Athens in Greece where, just another huge basketball country and city. There's a Giannis court there. I went and checked that out, but I was advised. People said, you know what? It's a great court and a great location, but it's not a great court to play on because, again, there's just so many people who are there playing, so you won't get a good run in. So instead, we went to a couple of different courts. I ended up playing a back-to-back in Athens as well there. So I think I ended up playing, I think it was 8 games in total in 17 days across 5 different countries and 7 cities or something like that. So more than I was expecting. Had an incredible time though, and really it sort of exceeded my hopes and expectations as to what I was looking for going into it.
And clearly, like, this is just stage one, right? Like, you have, you said that was actually like seven cities, right? Although that was not that was seven cities in across four countries?
Five countries, yeah.
So in theory, you have either 13 cities or 15 countries to go. I don't know how you're going to square this or how firmly you're holding yourself to the concept. But let's put that aside for the moment. As you're doing this, Lee, and it sounds like just a wonderful, amazing experience, you are doing this as there's multi-layers to this, right? There's personal journey. There's just the exploration aspect of it. Obviously, you've married your two favorite things, travel, international travel and basketball, all of which is wonderful. But this is self-funded, as I understand it. Quick shout out again, by the way, to Ben Golliver at the Washington Post, who wrote a fantastic story about what Lee is doing. You're self-funding it. I assume you were encountering quite a bit of hospitality as you go, though. You've got a lot of followers on Instagram, people who were eager to meet you and play basketball with you. So there's that aspect of it. But somewhere in the midst of all this, I as I understand it, or I suspect, there will be some end result. How much are you documenting this? How are you documenting this? Since you're kind of a one-man crew right now, when you know the girl comes out and starts, you know, like schooling you in Frankfurt. You don't have like some crew following you to like get her shooting from behind the backboard as this all unfolds. So like, how are you capturing like the coolest moments that I assume will one day become something that we will all watch on YouTube or, you know, Amazon Prime, Paramount Plus, Netflix? I don't know. There's too many services to count anymore. how will this all, you know, kind of congeal into an end result that we can all kind of, you know, share your travels with you, appreciate, you know, what you have found, learned, seen along the way?
Yeah, well, ultimately the end goal is to attract one of those streaming services to come along and obviously be able to produce it and finance it and fund it and have the crew follow me around. Now, that was always going to be the biggest challenge for me at the start because the idea is harder to sell. I mean, you know, you everyone's got ideas and everyone wants funding for their projects and things like that. So
everyone wants somebody to pay them and film them while they run around the world eating amazing food in amazing cities playing basketball. Yes, yes, we would all love that. If anybody wants to do that for me, I'm a terrible basketball player, but I'm really good at eating food in international cities. My email address is easy to find. People with lots of money come find me. All right, sorry, Lee. Back to your thing.
Well, and so when you say it out loud, obviously it is very tough for anyone to sort of come on at the start. So I knew this first trip was more about a proof of concept as far as, so one of my friends, he's actually a stay-at-home dad, and he when I sort of said the idea to him, I sort of didn't even really invite him per se, but I told him what I'm doing. He's like, well, I'll come along. I'll shoot that. I need, you know, he's unemployed at the moment and his wife was very supportive of the idea. So basically he's the one shooting most of it there just on phones. Mm-hmm. I had other cameras and things, but again, I'm trying to do, you know, content creation, scouting locations, organizing the games, organizing hotels and everything like that. So, you know, I knew that this first trip wasn't going to be this, you know, beautifully edited and produced feature series that I can just, you know, put up on my own YouTube channel. I'm putting together little clips and bits and pieces as I'm going. And the response so far has been very, very encouraging. In fact, I've had quite a few people reach out and sort of say, hey, how can we help? How can we get involved? And I'm having those conversations now because for the second leg, I obviously do want to try to make it a little more polished so that, you know, if someone like Netflix or Amazon, Paramount, any of those, I'm more than happy to have those conversations. They can at least come along and say, okay, we see what you're doing here. And now we can take that to another level. Yeah. So, you know, but again, part of the reason I'm doing this in the first place is, you know, if you try to plan everything and wait for the timing to be right and try to line up all your ducks, you sort of wouldn't do anything. You know, you sometimes have to just like, I'm doing this, and I'm going to go and see how I can make it work. And so many of the things as well, like the thing in Frankfurt, I mean, I didn't plan that at all. You know, there was no way of even possibly planning that. It was circumstance because of a delayed flight that I was like, well, what am I going to do? I'm going to sit at the airport and complain about something, or am I just going to go out and see what I can find? And again, it turned out to be some of the best content that I got, which I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, to be honest with you. But
no, I think it's an amazing thing. Let me, yeah, like that's a wonderful thing.
And that sort of is the whole thing. I'm not putting any pressure on myself here where this has got to be perfect and this has got to be, everything's got to be captured and the story's got to be told. It's a learning experience. It's all about trying to understand what works, what I'm capable of doing, where I need help, and how I can get that help. And that's the sort of thing is I really ideally need a cameraman, editor, producer all in one, you know, who's available, who's cheap, who's able to come with me, who, you know, can do all that. But again, some of the conversations I've had in the last week or so make me feel pretty optimistic that the second trip will be better than the first in terms of what I shot. But again, I'm dealing with what I have right now. I'm trying to put it out there. You know, I think so far anyway, the response has been pretty impressive that people are like, yeah, I can see what you're doing. I mean, it's not perfect, but hey, that's you know it shouldn't be perfect either the first time. I mean, it's all about trying to understand what it is I'm trying to do and if it's got any traction and engagement. And the messages I've received from people, I got a message yesterday from a guy in Kyrgyzstan. I can't even say it, Kyrgyzstan, saying, hey, if you're ever out here, we have a great run on a Wednesday night. And I'm like, I had no idea basketball even existed in sort of that. I had three people from Karachi in Pakistan saying, you have to come to Karachi and play basketball. Wow. And I'm just like, these are the sort of destinations that I would never have considered. But when you have three people saying you've got to come out there, I'm not going to Karachi anytime soon, but at some point I would love to go out there and play. So, you know, those are the things that sort of motivate me and encourage me to believe that, okay, there is something there. Now I just have to do the best I can to try to turn it into something a little more, a little more watchable and as far as appealing to one of the big streaming services.
Yeah, I can't imagine why it wouldn't be. And I think, you know, not to, you know, make the pitch for you, you will make it better than I possibly can. But no, I mean, as I'm processing, as I'm thinking about it, think about like the times we're living in. You know, we are still going through this global pandemic that has shaken the world, and people will put their own interpretations on where we are in the course of that pandemic. It's not really over, but we're treating it like it's over. But we've gone through some severe convulsions. There are political convulsions ongoing, all kinds of things that have fractured us, things that have caused us to pull back, things that where we were, you know, we were literally in lockdown not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
At a time like now, that you are taking this initiative to put everything aside and leave your family for days, weeks at a time as well. I want to talk about that a little bit too. But to go do this and, you know, doing, you know, Ben Golliver already used the reference, so I feel guilty replicating it, but it's the best analogy, like being like the Anthony Bourdain of basketball. You are exploring the world and other cultures and via basketball, but via everything else too, and finding connections. And I just cannot imagine a more important message or experience that we can all tap into at a time like now. And so, streaming services, where are you at? Like, this seems like an obvious one to me. I think it is, you know, it is the great cliche that sports bring us together. Sports can also divide. We see it on Twitter literally every minute of every day.
Yeah.
but it does still have those redeeming, unifying qualities too. And here you are, a stranger, getting people reaching out on social media saying, come to our city. And there's the civic pride wrapped up in there and a cultural pride and also an admiration clearly of what you're doing. And like all of those things are so resonant. Yes, I can't wait to see who picks this up and where. I'm subscribed to all of them, so I will be able to see it eventually anyway. I spend $5,000 a month, I believe, on streaming services and satellite. But
yeah. Well, I'm looking for a salesman too, Howard. So if you've got a bit of a side hustle there, you can certainly make some pitches there for me. But
you know what? We'll talk offline. I could use it a couple extra bucks out of your vast budget. You mentioned these in passing, and they were almost such like throwaway lines as you're going through. And then I was here, and then I was there, and then I saw this person, and I played with this person, whatever. You met Luka Doncic's father, and Drazen Petrovic's mother.
Yes.
But Drazen Petrovic's mom being in a Petrovic museum is one thing. Luka's father, as I understand it, Luka's father does not talk to a lot of people about Luka. Like he's not, I don't think he's done any interviews since Luka came on the scene. His mom has been around. but I believe they've been split for a long time. And it's always been this kind of mysterious kind of, yeah, no one talks to Luca's dad. That's an off limits area or whatever. I don't know. Are you allowed to say? What can you tell us about Luca's father?
Yeah, no. Another friend or person who follows me on Twitter, Luca Stuchin, in Slovenia, I just said to him, listen, I'm coming out to Slovenia. I want to play a game. And I can't remember exactly how it came about, but I said, do you have any connection to Saša Doncic? And he said, yeah, I work with him. And I said, well, do you think he'd be open to an interview? And he said, well, let me ask him. And so we went out there and he set it all up and it was incredible. Saša was a very, you know, charming, welcoming, very funny man, you know, very, very hospitable. And so, again, his English is not perfect. It's good enough, certainly better than my Slovenian. But, you know, I also wanted to make the interview not just about Luka. I wanted to sort of explore basketball history and culture really in the Balkans, because and this is another part of the reason why I chose that destination first. When you think of history of European players, like the Balkans has produced some incredible athletes, basketballers included. And I think Dražen being, you know, one of the probably the first real European star, and he took a couple of years to get going there in Portland before New Jersey. It sort of said to me, like, there's got to be something here. And then, of course, there's Vlade and Peja Stojakovic and the Bogdanovics throughout the year. So this is not just a fluke. And you only have to look at the MVP right now, Jokic, Nikola Jokic, of course, from Serbia. So this is a very rich culture, a very rich history of basketball tradition. And so for me, that was very appealing. I'd never been to that part of the world as well. And I thought, why not? And anyway, so we had the interview there with Saša, and then he said, afterwards, he said, you know, do you want to come out and have a Slovenian dinner, like a barbecue? And I was like, yeah, of course. You know, that's the other part of this journey. I don't want to, I'm not just going to sit in the hotel and eat, food in the hotel. I want the full experience. And so I thought maybe, you know, we'd have an hour and a half dinner, a glass of wine and chat some more. And 5 hours later, we were still at the table there, still just listening to Saša telling us stories. And again, just entertaining, like, you know, his experiences himself being a very good basketball player, now being the father of, you know, maybe an MVP of the NBA. You know, there's a lot of, he's obviously a very big celebrity in Slovenia. I mean, he was kind of a celebrity anyway, but now being the father of Luka, I think has sort of elevated that even higher. But he's at the end of the day, just another guy who likes to have fun, have a meal, have a couple of drinks and, you know, tell stories. And that was the thing is, like, I never felt at any point during the dinner, I was like, oh, I think I'm taking up too much of his time. Instead, it felt like he was having a great time and so was I. And so it's another one of those experiences that part of it wasn't planned and wasn't recorded or anything like that. It would have been, I mean, that would have been an episode itself, just dinner with Saša Doncic. I tell you, that would have done really well with the ratings. But unfortunately, I wasn't. And some, there's a certain, I think, change as well. If people are on camera, they act differently and they speak differently and they feel like, well, I need to present differently. And he was so entertaining and so much fun. And I, you know, I hope one day I'll be back there and I'll go out for dinner with him again and just continue it on, because it was a really, really, those are the sorts of experiences that I'm hoping for as well. You know, it's where it's like, what an incredible memory that is. It was just a dinner, you know, everyone's going out for dinner, but it's different when you're with somebody who's giving you, right, this is what we eat in Slovenia, this is what we drink, and this is how it goes. And, you know, at the end of the night, my friend Luca, who came out with us, the funniest thing was he had to go and change from his jeans into his sweatpants. He was eating too much. He said, I don't usually even eat this much. So, but again, this, you know, what you were saying before, this is kind of what has been missing, I think, from the world in recent times, is like, at the end of the day, we're all way more alike than we are different. And when you have those social interactions and you have a dinner and you drink and things like that, you just get to know people. And that to me is what's really, really fun about traveling. I was fortunate that I grew up in a family. Mum and dad liked to travel a lot. And so I think the seeds were planted in me very young. And all my life experiences, so many of them anyway, have been about just traveling without knowing necessarily what's going to happen. Just sort of going with the flow. And I've got some incredible memories, and now I've even added to that collection.
No, it's fantastic. So at least some part of your time with Saša Doncic was an actual formal interview. So we will at some point see some bits of that, right? We'll get a little of his perspective. Maybe he'll tell us how he felt about the Mavericks blowing the whole Jalen Brunson situation, which is clearly hurting Luka's chances at a lot of things right now, including MVP, because if they're not winning, that's certainly going to hurt that, to say nothing of their playoff hopes. I look forward to that, because like I said,
I actually have got that up on my own YouTube channel already. So I put that together. So I'll share that with you. And I trimmed it down. It was about sort of 15 minutes, but I trimmed it down to 5 minutes simply because, again, trying to establish that audience and that crowd. 15 minutes. No one's got attention span for 15 minutes at the start here anymore. But maybe I can flush that out and get a couple of episodes out of it anyway down the road.
What's the real quick, the YouTube channel? How do they find it? What's the...
Just my name, Lee Ellis 76. 76 is the year of birth. So
gotcha.
That gives away a little bit of my age here.
You're young. And then similar on Instagram, right?
Yeah, Instagram and Twitter without the 76, just my name. Yeah. I was around early enough to be able to establish those two handles, which is great. I am on TikTok too, but you know what? I mean, look, I can play basketball for 2 hours on concrete and not feel old. I can spend 10 minutes on TikTok and I feel like I'm about 1,000 years old. So I am on there, but I'm not sure that's my platform. So
yeah. And people who know you from over the years, from No Dunks, from the starters, from everything else, they know like you've got some game. This is not like this basketball is more than just a passion for you as a fan. Like you can act like you can shoot. You shot around with Steph Curry, for God's sake. Still an amazing thing for any of us, including you, I think, to contemplate that this was and you got paid to do it. Besides, you are living the dream, my friend, to say the least. So what are you finding about when you play these pickup games in all these far flung places with total strangers and in countries where you don't necessarily know that much of the language? What are you finding out about the game and about the way people play the game? You know, you can step on any court and I'm sure hold your own and whatever, but like you start a pickup game and things just evolve in a certain way and it can vary city to city. So what, give me a couple highlights of what you've learned about the way people approach the game or approach pickup. What are the basketball things at the true grassroots level, the hard court level, the asphalt level, the blacktop level? I don't know what I'm reaching for here. You get the idea.
No, well, I think the biggest lesson has been that in the Balkans, it's all 3-on-3, half court. Pickup basketball is all that, because in Ljubljana for the first game, we had, as I say, sort of 15 people turn up. So I just assume we'll play full court 5-on-5 so everybody could be involved. And that's the other thing. If you turn up to my game, I want you to play. I don't want to be like, well, are we going to run subs? And anyway, so when I proposed that to the guys, everyone's looking at me funny, like no one plays 5-on-5 full courts out here. We can play 3-on-3 at both ends so more people can play anyway. And as it turned out, we actually did play 5-on-5 because they sort of said, well, we'll do it because you said it. And I was like, guys, honestly, let's do what you do. Don't do what I do. Anyway, that's beside the point, because what did happen, though, that ball just moves around. And when you think of Jokic and you think of Doncic, you think of their passing, their court vision and things like that. It is no surprise when you see what the grassroots level of basketball is like in those countries. You know, in America, when you often play, you know, whether it's 4-on-4 or 5-on-5, there's a lot more one-on-one, a lot more ISO of like, you know, guys trying to sort of show each other up. The ball doesn't move around as much. Not a criticism, just a difference in how the game is played. But in the Balkans, you know, again, I picked up my man and you sort of think, oh, well, I don't need to run too far. Next thing I know, he's in the corner. Then there's a screen, a backdoor screen. I'm like, what is going on? He's getting an open look, knocking down threes. And you're feeling like, oh, I'm the idiot here who's just giving my man open shots. And they're all beautiful shooters as well. Like guys are, you know, really good shooters at the basketball. So very quickly, I was just like, I'm not worried here about whether or not I can make a shot or make a pass. I just don't want to get absolutely burned on the other end by my opponent. You know, I don't want to embarrass myself there. So that was the thing. And so pretty much everywhere I played, it was the same idea where it's like, we just play 3-on-3 where we can. And because we had a lot of guys, like for example, in Belgrade, we actually ended up playing full court fives there, but we just said to guys, like, just rotate in and out whenever you need a break. You know, no one's really keeping score. Excuse me. We're just playing for fun. And that was a good thing. But those summertime tournaments that are in Zagreb and in Belgrade and places like that, they're all 3-on-3. And so it's you can see how the game, it probably is more fun to play pickup in that sense, because you're always involved in the play. You know, there is when you play 5-on-5, and I know myself from playing here, sometimes you might go 10 possessions and barely even get a touch of the ball. Mm-hmm. But in 3-on-3, you've got to be moving on both sides of the ball, offense and defense, because otherwise you're going to either get an opportunity to score or your man is going to be wide open if you're not keeping up with him. So that would probably be the biggest part of it that I learned, that it's just out there, it's way more focused on smaller teams, but a ton more ball movement. And but also really, really fun to play. And again, you also understand Ljubljana, Slovenia is only 2 million people. I think it is just over. And then when you've got the, you know, potentially an MVP of the NBA and a team that's considered one of the best teams, they won the Euros in 2017. And I think they finished, what, fourth in the Euros last or this year. It's incredible that they're able to produce such a high level of basketball when you think, I mean, what's the population of California and New York? I mean, they're, you know, 10 times the size of those countries, yet the basketball growth and development there is incredible. So it's passionate as well. Very, very passionate. I went to a Serbia versus Turkey World Cup qualifier while I was in Belgrade. This was an incredible atmosphere. I mean, only 8,000 people, but it felt like this was almost like a championship game. Now, Serbia won by a point, and it was just an incredible atmosphere. So basketball, it's no surprise. It's a very, very passionate pursuit out there. People take a lot of pride in it, and there's some really, really good basketball players.
Where are you most eager to go, or do you know, like, do you have the rest of this tour mapped out? Is it just going to evolve as you go? Where's your next trip set up for? How many more cities? Give me a sense of like where you think this will go. Also, over how long? Because this is obviously, you know, it's an adventure, but you have a wife and two sons, correct?
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
So yep. So obviously there's, you know, there's a balance here too for you personally. So how long does this go? Where else do you think you're heading?
Well, so ultimately it depends if I'm able to get financial backing and support. I mean, and I planned it to the point where I know up to about probably if I can get to 10 or 15 countries and there's no interest and there's no traction, then that will be an indication that it's probably not going to go anywhere. But if I can get to sort of 15 countries and then I'm getting, and it doesn't have to be a streaming service, but if I'm getting support from local cities and countries where they're like, oh, we want an opportunity here to show off our city and country, which I've found that's where a lot of interest is coming from, then it can allow me to sustain it. So, you know, this is not a like, I'm not got my last 20 bucks in the casino and it's got to work or else I'm, my kids and wife are out on the street. But I've also planned it to enough of a point where it's like, I can give myself a good chance to make this happen. And then the audience will kind of tell me from there. And so the next destination is South Africa. I'm going to be in Cape Town. I'm going to Zambia and then Kenya, where I got, again, a surprising amount of interest out there. And to me, those are the sorts of cities and countries that I really want to explore because they're not, again, traditional. You know, you don't automatically think of basketball when you think of those sort of places. So if there's that much interest for me, I really want to explore it. And I've had conversations with people that are like, yeah, we will sort of help you showcase what we want to showcase from our city and our country to, you know, try to attract a bigger audience. So there's that. And then, of course, the World Cup of Basketball is in Asia next year in the Philippines, Indonesia, and Japan. And the Philippines is maybe the most fanatical place for basketball that I have seen. I have had so many people saying, you must come to Manila, must come. And I'm like, well, I think it makes sense to try to time it around the Basketball World Cup if I can. So I'm aiming on being in Asia around August next year. I'm aiming on being in Africa in around February, March, and then in Europe, probably in the sort of June, July time. Now, you mentioned my wife and children too. So that's the other, obviously the huge concern here. I can't just say I'm off for 8 months playing basketball. I mean, my wife is incredibly loving, incredibly supportive, but at the end of the day, we all know you have to make sure I'm honoring my responsibilities as a husband and a father first, which I am. But my wife, this wouldn't happen if she wasn't fully supportive of this endeavor. And, she's from Peru. She was born in Peru, raised in Lima. And then she's lived in Canada where we met. Now, for her, you know, when I sort of started talking about this idea, she grew up in a country where, you know, terrorism was potentially rife there. You know, the economy was kind of always unstable where, you know, you might have $10,000 in the bank one day and you might have nothing the next. So she grew up in an environment where, you know, things were, you know, challenging just to sort of, you know, to sort of keep going through everyday life. So when I pitched an idea about traveling the world playing basketball. It's not that big an obstacle in comparison to what she sort of experienced in life. And she also believes, like me, that again, you these opportunities, no one's going to come up to you and say, "Hey, you want to do this? We'll organize and do everything." You sometimes just have to grab that bull by the horns and say, "I'm going to go and do it and see what happens." And when you have the support of your wife and children, you realize, like, well, I may as well go for it and see what happens. And you know, at the end of the day, the NBA will still be there, and maybe I return to the NBA media world at some point. But for now, it's just an opportunity to try something else. And as you mentioned earlier, really blending my two passions, basketball and traveling, meeting people, exploring, having fun, and hopefully I can turn it into a career.
Skilled media person that you are, you have set up the segue perfectly. Thank you, Lee. I was sitting here, you know, trying to think while you're talking, how am I going to segue? But you just, you know, you just like threw it right out there like a pro. So let's get to how you got here and why you're doing this now and why you're not on the No Dunks podcast with your buddies Skeets, Tass, and Trey, who you had, you know, been broadcasting for over a decade, right?
Like, that's right, yeah.
You were part of that group. I'm gonna once again shout out / plagiarize my buddy Ben Golliver from his Washington Post story about you. Says, after taping more than 2,500 shows, it's just a staggering number, over the past 11 years, he felt the regular season was far too long, load management had run amok, and a number of superstars had lost touch with the average fan. As I read that again, all I can think is, here you are, Lee, as somebody who has been immersed in the NBA, who has covered the NBA, who has had what a lot of people would have, again, thought dream job to be able to podcast about and do a TV show about the NBA, and from the most enjoyable way possible too, right? There's, you know, the ink-stained wretches like me, the curmudgeons who we're journalists, we're reporters, we got to report on all the good, the bad, otherwise, and speculate about trades and about who's, you know, everybody's a hero or a goat, and we have to, but you guys did this in the most joyous way possible as fans first. And so it was a celebration of the game, and often, you know, sometimes serious and sometimes very goofy ways of exploring it. That was the fun of it. That was the magic of the show that you guys had together all these years. And that obviously is continuing. But you left that for reasons that, as I just listed from the paragraph that Ben Golliver wrote, I think are very relatable to a lot of average fans, which is that there's aspects of the game, and this is not new. Every generation or every few years, there's, I think, a little bit of hand-wringing about some of these things. But for somebody like you, who is so passionate about the game, who loves it so much, and who had a career attached to it, to decide to walk away. And again, you just said it, you could walk back to it when this is all over. Tell me about, was there a single breaking point? What is it about the state of the NBA right now that really just started to feel like it was alienating to you, or not, you know, just you lost the fun of it?
Yeah. Well, I think, look, ultimately the main reason I did it wasn't because I was looking to leave the NBA. It was more this idea kind of was forcing itself on me, where I was like, if you're going to do it, you're going to have to do it. And you can't do the podcast and do this on the side. Like, it's one or the other. And at the time when I was sort of weighing everything up, you know, the lure of the NBA, having covered it for over 11 seasons professionally and being a fan for over 30 years, ever since I was a kid in Australia, you know, I think there was a little bit of burnout in that sense. And I think the biggest challenge for the NBA right now is making the regular season meaningful. And I think that's the biggest problem, is that regular season games, it feels like, you know, almost every night there's some team that's resting healthy players, multiple players. There might be a 40-point blowout. Guys seem to be, you know, just not almost giving everything every night. Now, again, I understand it's a long season for everybody, and you know, nobody wants to get hurt. Nobody's hoping they get injured or anything like that. But I think there are certain aspects of the regular season that just didn't quite have that same pull anymore. And as you mentioned, I think these things go through cycles as well. You know, when we had the COVID break, for 4 months there, that where there was no basketball, and it was like just snatched away from us. It was like, oh man, I miss it. But since then, it feels like we've just jammed like three seasons on top of each other. And so, you know, from one night to the next, you might see a team, you know, lose by 30 or 40 points one night, and then they're resting players and things like that. And you're sort of like, well, as an analyst, and you know this yourself, if you're trying to write stories, it's very, very difficult sometimes to analyze a team if they're resting players and, you know, there's a marquee game that they don't seem to even really treat that as any different to any other regular season game. I mean, we know that sometimes on those Saturday night primetime ABC games, it's like, well, hang on, this guy's just resting? Like, that's not a good look for the NBA. So, and I think, you know, combined with that, we've had way too many storylines that are probably not that exciting for fans to listen to. I mean, we don't have to get into them right now, but, you know, there are things that kind of like, you're sort of like, I don't really, that guy doesn't sort of have that same pull for me anymore because I'm not quite sure which direction he's going in after the game. And I look, I want the players to feel free to express themselves in whatever way they want possible, but that can be sometimes a little bit off-putting, I think, for fans. So there was a combination of factors. And I go back as well. The very 1998-99 lockout season was when, you know, when Jordan retired and then they had a lockout. And that's when I first moved overseas to England. And at the time, I, you know, again, was looking for a new experience in life, and I found soccer, and all of a sudden I became this huge soccer fan, and I didn't really miss the NBA. And so what happened was for a year or two there, I sort of did turn away from the NBA, but then I moved to Toronto. Vince Carter was on the Raptors. That was just before he had that incredible series with Allen Iverson, the 7-game series there. So, you know, all of a sudden then I was like, oh my God, it's like that girlfriend that you've missed. And you're like, oh, I absolutely love her again. So I fell back in love with the game after taking a bit of a hiatus there, you know, over 20 years ago now. But so I think it's okay to be like, you know what, I want to see what else is out there in life, and I want to try something else. And again, I want to try something where I'm like, I am fully responsible for everything I do here. All the decisions I make are mine, so I can accept them, whether they're the right ones or the wrong ones. I'm not dependent on anybody else making these decisions. And that's kind of empowering, I think, where you're like, okay, well, you can't blame anybody. I can't say, well, my wife didn't support this, or, you know, I wasn't able to do this. I've been incredibly fortunate that living a life where I've traveled a lot, I've experienced many different cultures and countries around the world. I believe I've had the education to understand, like, I know kind of what it takes to travel. I kind of know what it takes to make content. Now it's trying to sort of just mend all those things together. And as I say, I still keep my eye on the NBA, of course, but I just don't, you know, I see sometimes where teams are resting healthy players and you're just like, that's the NBA needs to really figure this out, because I think they could be losing more fans by that. If I take my boys to a game here in Atlanta, and let's just say hypothetically, it's the Hawks versus the Lakers. Well, you know, you want to see LeBron, you want to see Anthony Davis. Now, if those guys are healthy, but they're not playing, and you're spending $150, $200 on tickets, you're going to leave with a bit of a bad taste in your mouth, I think. And that's, you know, like you can't force guys to play 82 games, but the feeling that players are sort of all doing it on their own schedule has become, I think, a little bit more dominant in the last year or two.
Yeah, and I think the story that Ben Golliver did about you, he mentioned, you know, the James Harden situation, and you know, obviously we're in an era here of, you know, there's an unprecedented number in the last 5 years of stars forcing trades, like, and Harden, of course, twice in like 13 months. So there's that aspect. I think the story also mentioned, you know, Kevin Durant's, trade demands / demand of firing people and all that. I mean, there's always been some elements of that, but it does feel like the NBA right now in this player empowerment era that things have moved, you know, so far in that direction. And it's just, this leads into boring CBA stuff, but I do wonder where it, I do wonder yeah. where it all leads for the league, because, you know, at some point the league office and franchise owners are going to want to, you know, claw back some of the power that they have ceded, and that's going to be a problem. Then again, they're all making billions, and my general philosophy on this is, if the league is making billions and no one's losing money, franchises are fine, they're just going to roll over into the next deal. No one's going to try to upset the apple cart. And that's my gut instinct on that. Okay, enough CBA talk. That said, the concerns you raised are concerns that I think a lot of fans have. If you had 5 minutes with Adam Silver, I don't know. I mean, this is maybe too big of a question to try to tackle in a very brief span. But like, if you could make this plea directly to the league, like, hey, you know what? Some of us who love the game still are finding it hard to be as invested as we once were. can you just fix these three things? I don't know if that's ban load management. I don't know if that's possible. I don't know if that's ban trade demands. I don't know if that's but like, where would you go with that?
Well, I would start with the draft, because anytime you still have incentives for losing, I think that's the problem. And I know Adam Silver follows soccer model. Now, you know, he's trying to implement the mid-season tournament, I believe, right, next season, which
part, is part of the efforts, by the way, to address what you said, which is make the regular season meaningful again.
Yes. And so that's kind of focused on like the Champions League or the FA Cup, which is, you know, an additional tournament outside of the regular season for a soccer tournament, which is fine. But again, if the reward is only money, I don't really see why that's going to incentivize. Like, if you're giving millionaires another $1 million to play a tournament, to me, that doesn't do anything. So where I would focus is in soccer. So we have the promotion relegation at the end of the season. Now, three teams from the Premier League get relegated, the bottom three teams, and three teams from the first division go up. Now, I'm not saying we do promotion relegation, but what I would do is say the incentive here is these teams at the bottom, they are fighting to the death, to the end of the season. That battle between the bottom five to six teams for the, over the last month or so is always awesome, because it's like these teams are clinging on to stay in the Premier League. Premier League means more money, means the bigger TV contracts, means better gates, more merchandise, all that. The financial incentive is there, and you just want to be in the Premier League. So what I would say to Adam Silver is I would say, okay, whoever finishes the last two with the worst two records in the NBA, you don't get a draft pick, or you get to pick last and second last, and then make the other teams that don't make the playoffs, make it a real lottery, so that it's like there is no incentive for teams to be resting veterans towards the end of the season. No incentive. And again, when it comes to injuries, you don't want to be skeptical, but we know in the past where there's been healthy young players almost playing too well, where a team's like, you can just have the last 10 games off here because we want an extra 1.5% chance of a lottery ball. So once you remove that incentive that, okay, everyone we know wants to land Victor Wembanyama next season. Of course they do. If we see a race to the bottom where it's like, I know there's been other times throughout the season where in the last two or three games, you see guys no one's ever heard of playing 44 minutes in a game. That to me is the biggest area that the league needs to focus and say, okay, you finish bottom, you're not getting a draft pick. And so let's just see then if those teams are resting guys like Al Horford, who was sent home from the Oklahoma City Thunder. He just signed on for two more years. He was great in the final. So it's not like Al Horford couldn't play anymore or he was washed up. Yeah. It was like, we don't want that veteran, you know, going out there and playing steady minutes. We instead want to increase our chances. So the draft in theory is a beautiful thing. It's like, man, you had a bad season. Maybe you luck out because you get the number one pick. But we have seen far too many examples. And this goes back, I mean, the Houston Rockets did it with Hakeem Olajuwon and Ralph Sampson. So it's not like this is a new thing, you know. But whilst if you're basically saying to your players, and of course the Sam Hinkie era as well, where it's like, we're not even trying to win, I think that's a big problem. And if you are rewarding that, then teams are going to continue to not try when they feel they're better off at doing it. Now, is it a perfect solution? Probably not. But I feel that you're not going to see towards the end of the season where it's like, all right, we've got to win five of our last six games or else we don't get a draft pick. I think you're going to see those teams then trying to play and trying to compete and trying to win. And that's ultimately what it should be about, especially, again, if you're a fan, you want to be able to know if you're taking your kids to the game, this team is competing to try to win every single night. And I don't think you see that. Again, there's not one team in particular. It's across the board. Every team is sort of guilty of it to some degree. But again, you're incentivizing losing. In soccer, the incentive is absolutely you do not want to lose because it's going to cost you big time.
Yeah. I know the league is very proud of, and I think rightfully so for the most part, within limits, the fact that creating the play-in tournament, creating or changing the lottery odds has incentivized more teams to try to play harder later into the season. It's not perfect, and it is not down to the, you know, teams 27 through 30, really, right? But everybody else, what they've at least gotten now is that I think what the way that they have framed it to me is, you know, 25 out of 30 the last couple of years have stayed in the race because they're either, you know, lower in the standings and trying to get to the top six so that they don't fall into, so they don't end up in the play-in, or they're trying to get to the play-in from the maybe 11th, 12th, 13th spots, whatever. But yeah, I mean, obviously you're right, Lee. Like, there's still a handful of teams that we knew from day one weren't even going to try, and the later in the season it got, the less they were trying. And and that part, even if there's fewer teams doing it, it's still happening. It's still something the league has to address. And I know that they very badly want that in-season tournament. I remain a heavy skeptic. Apologies to certain friends at the league office. I remain a very heavy skeptic of the in-season tournament. I know it works in soccer. We're a little different here. And I know, I don't know if especially American fans will embrace that or see the allure of it. I don't know if the players will, frankly, but if that juices up the regular season and it works, I will gladly admit I was wrong.
And I think all of us would too. I like the end of season play-in tournament. I think
that I do love. Yes.
Yeah. But the only problem with it is you don't want the last games 83 and 84 to be the only ones that all of a sudden people are really now trying to win. You know, and we've even had a couple of blowouts. I know the Hornets haven't performed all that well in those tournaments. But the main thing is at least the league's trying something. And I think for the most part, absolutely, it has worked. And again, I'll just sort of reference the point with soccer. You mentioned 25 out of 30. It's great. But there is 20 out of 20 going. And there are the different incentives as well, because you want to get into either the Europa League if you're sort of mid-table, or you want to get into that Champions League spot if you're you know, an Arsenal, a Chelsea, a Manchester United, and things like that, because there are so many incentives to make sure you're competing to that final day. And that, you know, again, like, we know that kind of post All-Star break, you can tell which teams really are just like, okay, we're not even pretending anymore. We just want to, you know, sink our team to get the higher odds. But again, when you're an analyst, and you're like, well, what's the point of even looking at this team if they're not even trying to win? So, you know, but again, there's no, you know, I'm sure Adam Silver has had a million different suggestions and people have offered up, you know, oh, just do this, just do that. It's not that easy. But I just think, for example, I would say, imagine a team that gets relegated from the Premier League then says, okay, well, you can sign Cristiano Ronaldo next season as your number one. That's the incentive you're getting. I mean, that wouldn't make sense to anybody. Everyone would say, well, why would you give that team that was so bad the best player available out in the draft or in the pool of players? So it wouldn't happen. Instead, it's like you have to manage your players better. You have to work around the perimeters of you know, the fringes of trying to get back into the Premier League. And those races from the teams in the league below to get in as well, they're incredible. So but overall, a promotion relegation won't work because there's just simply not a league that you can drop down to. And imagine Mark Cuban's Dallas Mavericks got relegated to like the G League or something like that. Can you imagine that? I mean, it'd be great for content, but
and that's the thing. Like, people have said this semi-seriously, and Adam Silver at one point, I think, did not do enough to dismiss this. And so it got life for about 24 hours in the aggregation cycle. But you cannot promote whoever the best G League teams are. I don't even know who that would be. The best G League teams cannot compete in the NBA.
No.
And NBA teams being relegated to the G League would be comical. It's not a reasonable solution, as much fun as it sounds to just, I love the idea of it. I love how vindictive it feels. Like, yeah, relegate that team. They suck. They've been mismanaged for years. Go ahead and relegate. Like, yeah, but it doesn't actually practically work for the NBA, unfortunately.
No.
So,
no.
Maybe in some other century. All right, before we wrap up, you had alluded to on your last time with the No Dunks podcast that there was a book or two possibly coming. Anything that you can say, what can people be expecting aside from obviously eventually some version of your world tour? But what's coming on the book front?
Yeah, well, I am hoping to have some sort of documentation of this journey and this travel. But and I'm speaking with a few different people about trying to figure out the best way to make that happen. Because as I said off the top, when you're trying to do everything, to then sit down and write for hours and hours on end is something that I simply don't have the time for
Especially if you've just had a 5-hour dinner with Luka Doncic's father, which I'm sure that there was some combination of alcohol plus a lot of food. That's not a great writing scenario, I can say.
No. I mean, and that, because I had to say, Sasha, I've got to catch a bus to Zagreb. I've got to go. I've got like 3 hours of sleep here before I'm going to Zagreb. Let me go here. But those are the sorts of things that I'm hoping that I can, again, I've realized like you have to basically recruit people to help you put all that stuff together. And hopefully it will be something that, again, is appealing. And And thanks to you for having me as well too, Howard, because all this promotion and publicity is what I'm also searching for. And it's been very, very fun talking with you about it.
No, it's been a blast talking with you about it. Thank you so much. It's funny because you and I have crossed paths over the years in various arenas and maybe even at the Turner Studios back when we were both under the Turner umbrella.
That's right.
And this is the longest conversation we've actually had. I don't know why it took this long. My bad. But no, this has been a blast. But before we go, I just got to say, like, I admire the hell out of what you're doing with this. I have never been the person who could just like walk away and just like take that kind of the leap of faith on something like that. So I admire the hell out of what you're doing. And as well as the concept itself, of course, as I said at the outset, I love, the themes that this brings to the table of just kind of making connections around the world, putting ourselves in perhaps, awkward and unique different situations, learning as you go. I mean, it's all just wonderful life lessons. There are lessons for everybody everywhere. I look forward to one of the streaming services funding and documenting this all because I can't wait to see it so we can all live vicariously through your travels. It's
well,
an
you
amazing
can come
thing.
With you. Hey, you can come with me if you want, Howard, and document it yourself. That would be very helpful. So you know what?
put a pin in that thought.
All right. Yeah.
I've still got some Delta miles to blow here somewhere. That would be fun. Lee Ellis, international man of mystery. 20 games, 20 cities, 20 nations. I'm getting this wrong, but something to that idea. Can't wait to see what's next, folks. Go follow him on Twitter and Instagram and YouTube so you can follow along. Lee, this has been a blast, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Howard.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Lee Ellis. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter, at Howard Beck.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Best Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.